Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I've heard that electric cars are just as bad for the environment as regular cars. Is this true?
Do you have questions about the climate emergency? Well, The Climate Question is the podcast where you'll find the answers.
It's important for all of us trying to think about, understand, and affect change in the world.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, I didn't know Egypt had a problem with malaria.
Actually, in Egypt, malaria goes way back till even during the pharaonic era, and the mummies, they found even that they got malaria. But what's happening currently from global warming, the mosquito itself is migrating. Hence, we find a lot of cases in North Africa that was not actually the case 20 years before that.
And now the fight is over, as the country is declared malaria-free. How did they do it? Neither a borrower nor a lender B from the International Monetary Fund, that is, Botswana, managed it, unlike almost any other country in Africa. Again, we ask, how did they do that?
Botswana has tried very careful fiscal management of the economy, and this is the main reason why Botswana has not opted for IMF borrowing in the past, nor does there seem to be a great willingness to adopt the stigma of a country that does borrow from the fund.
It's Tuesday, the 22nd of October. First, we go to Kenya. The government there has yet to respond to a highly critical statement from the United Nations condemning Nairobi for deporting four refugees to Turkey. The four men were sent back after being taken by masked men who are said to have been affiliated to Kenyan security forces over the weekend. The UN says it is deeply concerned by this and urged Kenya to abide by laws which prohibit the forced return of refugees. One of the men had been in Kenya for more than 20 years, and the incident is not without precedent. Let's find out what's been going on from our senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy, who was told about the incident by the people directly affected by it.
We heard from the Kenyan government. The first admission that they were involved in this came on Monday when a statement was released. And in it, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that Kenya had repatriated four refugees back to Turkey at the request of the government there. And that they said that they had received assurances that they would be treated with dignity. And that's when everybody just went into shock and, you know, one asking, is that how the Kenyan government operates, through masked men who are armed, abducting people in broad daylight and then just sending them off without informing their families about their fate? So people are very angry here. Human rights organizations are asking questions, and rightfully, the UN is also asking those questions because these were individuals who were under UN protection in Nairobi.
So do we know how many people have been abducted and sent back to Turkey, and how many of them managed to stay out of the hands of the Turkish authorities?
In this particular incident, seven people were abducted on Friday. Three of them were released by their abductors, the British national because of his nationality, and the mother and son, whose husband and father was sent back. So four men in total were repatriated. And previously, there has been an instance where one more member linked to this movement, the Gulen movement, was also repatriated to Turkey. So it is not without precedent, but still shocking in the manner in which it was executed and that it was done at all. And I should also add that a couple of decades ago, in 1999, there was the case of Abdullah Öcalan, who had taken refuge at the Greek embassy in Nairobi. He was also captured and sent back to Turkey. And since then, he is imprisoned in an island. And that was quite a high profile case that, you know, led to major diplomatic fallout between Turkey and Greece. So people are saying, you know, Kenya, and, you know, especially right now, one of the biggest criticisms against the Kenyan government right now is the fact that it just got joined the United Nations Human Rights Group. And people are saying what they're doing is not consistent with what the values that they should be espousing as a country that has been accepted into that organization.
So what's the Kenyan government saying about how it happened to be that four men were abducted by masked men at gunpoint and taken to an airport and allowed onto a plane when they're not supposed to have been allowed onto a plane because they were refugees?
They were refugees, and they even got a lawyer on Friday to write to all the airlines and the Civil Aviation Authority and the Airports Authority to remind them that there are laws against refoulement, that is sending, deporting people who have fled from their countries for different reasons and are legitimately seeking asylum, sending them back to the countries they fled from. Even that did not stop this sending back of the refugees. And the Kenyan government surprisingly admits to having taken part in this, they're calling it arrest and repatriation of refugees. So it's really shocking in that statement that they actually call them refugees, but at the same time, they're saying they're repatriating them. So it has raised serious, serious questions, but it is not without precedent. It is not the first time this has happened.
Let's talk about the men being Turkish and why they are in Kenya and how Kenya could allow this to happen with Turkish citizens who are seeking asylum in Kenya.
One of the men has been in Kenya for 20 years, according to his friends. And we haven't heard from the Turkish authorities yet about why they made this request to the Kenyan government to send them back to Turkey. So the link that people are trying to draw, because there's a precedent to it, is that these men are believed to be part of the Gulen movement. And it is a movement that has been on the spot in Turkey. The government there has been cracking down on their members within Turkey and outside. It has, in the same manner as we have witnessed here, brought back to Turkey members of that movement, and some of them have been allegedly subjected to persecution, which is why the human rights organizations have been raising the alarm about this decision by the Kenyan government to cooperate with the authorities in Turkey.
And why is the Gulen movement so prevalent in Kenya? I believe they run a network of schools in the country and also around the world. Are they quite present?
They are quite present. It has been silent because many people did not know about it until now. There was an incident a few years ago when a nephew of the founder of the movement was also repatriated from Nairobi. But there wasn't much talk about that particular time. But they are involved in a lot of philanthropic and education activities in Kenya. I have been speaking to people who work with these men who have been sent back to Turkey. They say that they have been running one of the top schools in Nairobi and Mombasa. One of them is the chairman of that school. They have been involved in interreligious organization activities where they bring together religious leaders from different faiths to discuss how they can work harmoniously together through an institute called Harmony Institute. So they have been very active on the philanthropic front as well as in the education sector here in Kenya.
And why would their activities in Kenya be problematic for the government in Turkey?
The founder of the movement had a major fallout with the president of Turkey, and he himself had fled the country. He was living in the US until his death yesterday. And therefore, there had been a crackdown ongoing against his members. And in 2016, there was an attempted coup for which he was blamed. And that just heightened the crackdown by the Turkish authorities against followers of this movement who are said to be in the millions.
So Kenya has acknowledged that they have sent these people back. Have they in any way addressed the fact that they were not supposed to do this? Have they addressed the breaking of UN conventions on the repatriation of refugees?
Not at all. In fact, there has been an attempt at justifying their actions, saying that they've received assurances from the Turkish authorities that these people who've been sent back to their country against their wishes will be treated with dignity, notwithstanding the fact that they fled to Kenya in the first instance, they were seeking asylum, they were registered refugees, and that the UN High Commission on Refugees, they had registration numbers, they were actively seeking asylum at the time they were captured and sent back. So the Kenyan government has not made any attempt to address the concerns about the breach of both national and international laws in the way that it has acted, and human rights organizations have accused them of flouting those laws that govern non-refoulement of asylum seekers. But they have, you know, gone ahead to talk about their cooperation with the Turkish authorities.
That's senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy in Nairobi. Egypt conjures up images of pharaohs and pyramids and tombs of football greatness, even the Arab Spring. It's not a country I associate with malaria. Malaria is caused by the female Anopheles mosquito, which may or may not be among the sounds you just heard. The infection from those mosquitoes kills up to 600,000 people a year, most of them children and most of them in Africa. Up to 250 million people suffer from malaria, but Egyptians won't be among them anymore. Their country has been declared malaria-free by the World Health Organization, and it's only the third country in the Eastern Mediterranean to do so. But malaria has long been in Egypt, our ignorance of the issue notwithstanding. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, praised Cairo, saying a disease that once plagued the pharaohs now belongs to its history, not its future. So how did Egypt conquer malaria? And can it stay malaria-free? Dr. Islam Anan is assistant professor and consultant of health policy and health economics at FUE, a private university in Egypt. I had to begin with ululations for achieving what so many other countries are trying to do. So I think congratulations are in order for Egypt being declared malaria-free after apparently a 100-year struggle to get to this status, to rid Egypt of a plague that essentially affects millions, hundreds of millions of people around the world. And so many people die from it, especially in Africa. Now, I must say that I had never thought that malaria happens in Egypt as well. For some reason, I just didn't associate Egypt with malaria. Why do you think that's the case?
It's a very good question to start. Actually, in Egypt, malaria goes way back to even the dissection of the corpse during the pharaonic era, and the mummies, they found even that they got malaria. But it's because of the problem in the weather and what's happening currently from global warming, the mosquito itself is migrating from south to north. And hence, during the previous 20 years, we find a lot of cases in North Africa that was not actually the case 20 years before that. And because of the borders with Sudan, there are a lot of cases in Sudan, and the vector itself, which is the mosquito, is prevalent there. And it migrates because of the global warming to the borders to the south of Egypt.
So how did Egypt manage to declare itself malaria-free this year?
So the first and most important is the vector control. The vector control, which is the mosquito itself, to make sure that we don't have the mosquito across the borders. And spreading the culture of having bed nets and the indoors insecticide, especially in south of Egypt, is very important. Secondly, is to make sure as well that because we do have around 4 million immigrants from Sudan, that we don't have any immigrants having malaria. The second thing is vaccination for all the Egyptians if they are going to another country with malaria, to make sure as well they are not getting infected. And finally, and the most important thing is to make sure that we do have the culture among the south of Egypt, to make sure that we don't have any lakes, especially after rainfall or after the season of the rains, which will be actually happening in a couple of weeks, we don't have any residuals where mosquito can actually nourish and can live beside the lakes and so on.
So it was a concerted and combined effort using all the available tools. So vaccines as well, making sure that people used bed nets, testing. But the United Nations said that Egypt had been trying to limit human mosquito contact since the 1920s when it banned rice cultivation and agricultural crops near homes. Can you explain to our listeners how that happened and how effective that was?
Yes, exactly. So here we can speak about the strong political commitment, because you need to put a safe zone between the households and the houses of the farmers and the land they are actually cultivating, which was not the case prior to that. And hence, you're not going to find any stagnant water in that place. And usually they do what we call the insecticide by aeroplane spreading or over all the stagnant water, especially for cultivating in south of Egypt and near the borders of Sudan. And this is actually very effective. That's what happened in sub-Saharan as well. They are trying to do that. What happened in Morocco and Algeria. And it's actually very effective, although it will actually decrease a little bit the cultivating land itself, but it's very safe to make sure that we do have a safe zone between people and the vector itself, which is the mosquito.
Why was it such a priority for the Egyptian government, the health department, to eradicate malaria?
We're not talking only about clinical burden and a lot of fatalities, but we're talking as well for an economic burden. Malaria causes a lot of economic burden on any country because you are infecting and causing the deaths of the children, which is the next generation. Egypt put a vision in 2015 and by 2018 that we do have a vision for 2030 that we will be person-centric. It's very important because when you look at communicable disease, it was neglected in terms of budget, thanks to COVID maybe, that COVID highlighted that infectious disease is very important to be eradicated and prevented by a lot of budgets and a lot of resources and the research and development as well. And hence, if you have a country free of malaria, free of hepatitis C, for example, before that, free of polio, you will have a lot of economic nourishment, a healthy generation, which a healthy generation equals a good economy at the end, which is the vision of what Egypt is seeking by 2030.
So Egypt is only the third country in the Eastern Mediterranean to receive this certification. What does it need to do to maintain it?
It's very hard because you continue making the testing and even more testing to make sure that the 27 governorates, especially near the borders of Sudan, they don't have any vector, any mosquitoes, and they don't have any infection among immigrants coming from there or coming from Yemen, for example. And hence, to sustain that, it means that we need more budget than the budget we actually spent on the eradication itself. Every couple of years, 2 years exactly, the WHO recheck the eradication process, they recheck the monitoring, and it's among the WHO program for infectious diseases as well in Africa. And then what's very important, I believe, is to make a technology transfer and experience transfer to the sub-Saharan countries, because still, till now, we don't have enough vaccination for the sub-Saharan, near 200,000 deaths among children. Maybe last year it was 300 as well. So we need a lot of vaccination. As we've done in COVID, we need to have more vaccination. Imagine in Africa, the vaccination is not there. It will be arriving maybe in November, like a couple of 100,000 doses, which were not going to be sufficient. So we'll still be having a lot of mortalities next year as well. So I believe the most important thing about being the third country is to help the sub-Saharan countries as well to follow the steps that we made.
So what would you say other countries can learn from Egypt to get to the point where you are now as a country that has eradicated malaria after a 100-year-long process of trying to do so?
The first thing I could say, because I've witnessed two errors, is to allocate more budget towards preventive medicine. Because still in Africa, we are talking about 0.5% of the budget is going to preventive medicine, and the rest is going to non-communicable diseases like chronic diseases like diabetes and hypertension and so on. So putting a lot of budget, it will make it a lot of priority. Research is very important, making inspection every month. And then second priority is education. We need to educate the people there to change the culture, making sure that they are not living beside the stagnant water unless they do have the right insecticide. But still, of course, if we're talking about some countries in the sub-Saharan, there's a lack of financial resources. So maybe we are telling them a lot of advices, but they don't have the money to do it. So here comes the international funds. we need to allocate more international funds. The WHO is actually trying to collect funds for malaria year after year, but the countries contributing countries, they are not putting the right fund as they've done, for example, for HIV, as they have done, for example, for COVID. So all of the advices are not going to be that effective if we don't have the international fund from WHO.
Okay, then. Thank you very much and congratulations once again.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Islam Anan, Assistant Professor and Consultant of Health Policy and Health Economics at FUE, a private university in Egypt. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are battling to become the next president of the United States. But what will the result mean for the rest of the world? The BBC World Service brings you trusted news, analysis, and insight. Never miss a breaking story with the Global News Podcast. Hear the human stories behind the big issues on The Documentary. And for in-depth analysis of a major news story, listen to The Global Story. Search for The Global News Podcast, The Documentary, and The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Finance ministers and economists from around the world are gathering this week in Washington, D.C. for the annual International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings. High on the agenda is the issue of global debt. Now, we've been reporting about countries in Africa getting into ever deeper debt. Government measures to economize and raise more revenue locally have been met with angry protests across the continent. You know the countries I mean, most recently Kenya, Ghana, Nigeria, among others. Those countries that are not rocked by protest are not exempt from the pain. It's just that the people there are tired and trying to keep their heads above water. I'm looking at Egypt, Tunisia, and elsewhere. But there is one country that hasn't had to do any of this borrowing. It's one of only three African countries that has never borrowed money from the International Monetary Fund with its swingeing conditions and austerity measures. Well known for its stable democracy and diamond wealth, that country is Botswana. Razia Khan, Managing Director and Chief Economist for Africa and Middle East Global Research at Standard Chartered Bank, has been telling me how Gaborone has managed to avoid borrowing from the IMF.
There is good reason for this. If you consider Botswana's economic history, it's been very conservatively run. The government in Botswana traditionally had a history of running fiscal surpluses. There were some exceptions, such as the global financial crisis when mines had to be put under care and maintenance for an extended period. But outside of those crises or those mining-related downturns, Botswana has tried very careful fiscal management of its country, of the economy. And this is the main reason why Botswana has not opted for IMF borrowing in the past. For the most part, there just wasn't a need to borrow from the fund. The country also had a very conservative means of saving any surpluses that arose from the commodity wealth. It's one of the few African countries that has had a sovereign wealth fund into which it put some of its mining-related income for some time. And the combination of that fiscal conservatism, the unwillingness, if you like, to borrow from the IMF, even during the COVID crisis, means that it hasn't had a need for much of its history to borrow from the IMF, nor does there seem to be a great willingness to adopt the stigma of a country that does borrow from the fund.
Has it borrowed from any other sources?
Yes, during the global financial crisis, there was extensive borrowing from the African Development Bank. Botswana is, of course, the most highly rated economy in sub-Saharan Africa. And as a consequence of that, that's partly a reflection of its accumulation of mining-related savings over time. But it also reflects its hesitance to borrow from more commercial sources. So despite its very favourable rating, Botswana has not tapped international capital markets for a euro bond either, something that many of its peer economies have done very successfully for some time.
What are the measures by which Botswana is rated as the highest rated economy in Africa?
If you look at the ratings it receives from ratings agencies such as Standard & Poor's and Moody's, there is, of course, greater concern about the current outlook. We've just had the release of GDP figures for the second quarter, and in year-on-year terms, we've seen two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. This reflects the current weakness in the diamond market, but it will be a concern for an economy like Botswana, which in the past had had much more rapid rates of growth. But to go back to your question, on what basis do rating agencies give Botswana such a high rating? It's the relatively low level of external government debt. It is the track record of very conservative fiscal policy. It's the accumulation in the past, of course, of significant amount of FX reserves, the country's high savings rate, that has all contributed to the assessment that it poses a very low default risk.
And you said that Botswana doesn't like the stigma attached to borrowing from the IMF. What is that stigma, and why is Botswana not willing to attach itself to it?
Well, this is the subject of some controversy. During the COVID crisis, for example, many countries, South Africa included, that had not traditionally gone to the IMF, were willing to use whatever concessional sources of financing were available to them, including the emergency lending made possible by the IMF, rapidly disbursing emergency lending. At the time, Botswana took the view that even though the commodities market was very weak, understandably, given the global nature of the COVID crisis, even though it was going through an extended lockdown, it had ample fiscal resources that it had accumulated in the past on which it could rely to see it through that crisis. Now, of course, conditions are meaningfully different. Botswana does not yet have anything like an external balance of payments crisis. That is the typical reason that most countries would opt for an IMF program. So it isn't clear, even now, with recent weakness of GDP growth, mining-led growth has been weak. It isn't clear even now that Botswana faces enough external pressure to really justify going to the IMF.
When you say external pressure, what do you mean?
So when economists talk about external pressure, it's really a reference to, is their balance of payments in great trouble? Are they importing a lot more than they're able to export? Are they running out of foreign exchange reserves? The reason why Botswana is not seen as vulnerable is that it has adopted a crawling peg regime for its exchange rate. And this means in the event of shocks, external shocks, it is always able to adopt the flexibility of changing the rate of crawl, if you like, of its exchange rate against other major currencies and the South African rand. And that flexibility can act as a buffer.
Has the diamond industry affected Botswana's approach to debt from the IMF?
So there are two distinctions that need to be made. The first is Botswana's very careful, conservative management of its commodity earnings is the main reason why it has no history of having needed to go to the IMF to borrow. But the second point is that this ongoing reliance on diamonds does lend itself to a great vulnerability in the economy, as we're seeing right now. There is cyclicality in the diamond market. There are some years when diamond demand is robust, and other times, as like now, when diamond demand is a lot weaker, when the mining sector goes into a contraction because of the inability to sell enough diamonds, and given the country's historic reliance on a single commodity, that is no good thing. That is a vulnerability. Now, It's worth considering what kind of conditions the IMF might put in place if it were theoretically to arrange a program with Botswana. And on fiscal policy, Botswana has traditionally done well. Some economists have expressed concern that foreign exchange reserves may have to be drawn down on unless the diamond market turns around. But the IMF, in all likelihood, could also potentially push for a greater role for the private sector. Botswana for some years now has seen a leveling out of its growth profile. Diamond-related growth was very good for taking Botswana from an initial weak base. At independence, it was a poor country. It grew very fast. It grew faster than some of the Asian tigers early on in its economic history. But sustaining that growth and sustaining that growth only on the back of diamond wealth was not possible. Botswana faces the classic problem of what economists call the middle income trap. It grew very rapidly. It took its population out of poverty. But in terms of diversifying the economy now and encouraging the growth of the private sector and creating new avenues to drive future growth, Botswana does face a great deal of challenge. There is a need for policy settings to be recalibrated, and any IMF program, not that anyone is suggesting Botswana will go to the IMF soon, would likely include structural conditions, structural benchmarks, as they're called, to try to encourage this even more rapid diversification of the economy.
Razia Khan, the Managing Director and Chief Economist, Africa and Middle East Global Research at Standard Chartered Bank. And that's Focus on Africa for today. It was produced by Amy Leibovitz and Sunita Nahar here in London. Blessing Aderogba did her bit from Lagos. Oba Chibinga was the senior producer and Jonathan Greer, our technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are battling to become the next president of the United States. But what will the result mean for the rest of the world? The BBC World Service brings you trusted news, analysis, and insight. Never miss a breaking story with the Global News Podcast. Hear the human stories behind the big issues on The Documentary. And for in-depth analysis of a major news story, listen to The Global Story. Search for the Global News Podcast, the Documentary, and the Global Story, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.